Listen to Learn Audio Tapes presents Conflict Resolution for Couples by Dr. Susan Heitler. A clinical psychologist, Dr. Heitler is the author of the widely acclaimed book, From Conflict to Resolution. This tape was recorded live at a public lecture sponsored by Rose Medical Center in Denver. Listen to Learn Audio Tapes thanks Rose Medical Center for support in hosting this lecture, and thanks the audience participants for their helpful questions and comments. And now, Conflict Resolution for Couples with Dr. Susan Heitler.
Conflict Resolution for Couples. How can couples prevent conflict, resolve conflict, or wipe up after conflict if it emerges? That's our topic today. Let's start not by talking about marriage or talking about conflict, though. Let's talk about the weather. Let's talk about climate. Would you prefer to live in a climate with thunder showers, rainstorms, wind, dark drizzle, or warm sunshine? I think most people prefer warm sunshine, and there can be a little bit of variety. We don't need unremitting blue skies. Generally, the climate within a home also is most comfortable for people if it's mostly sunny. We have air conditioning and heating so that in our homes, the physical climate stays stable and in a comfortable zone. This talk today is to help us keep our emotional tone equally comfortable. We'll be talking specifically about conflict or disruptions to that comfortable climate zone as it applies to couples, but the same principles apply to relationships between parents and children, friends, and work relationships. Still, our focus today is on conflict prevention, resolution, and cleanup for couples. What do we mean by conflict? And usually when people think of conflict, they think of fighting. Today's discussion goes beyond fighting, though, because conflict can be expressed within a home in a number of different ways. By conflict, I mean times when there are differences, differences of opinion, differences between what people want, or differences that you can't identify but that are still making for some sort of friction. Those differences can be experienced as tension, as somebody feeling depressed, as well as in arguments or fighting or in more unfortunate circumstances as violence. Clearly, there are escalations when we're talking about conflict. Conflict can be quiet. Differences can stick to the topic but still get more heated, or can erupt, as it does in war, in attempts at injuring one another. Hopefully, as a result of listening to the dialogue we'll have today, the escalations that really become hurtful can be eliminated. You'll be able to learn to utilize conflict as an opportunity for building collaboration, cooperation, warmth and affection and caring, those elements that give us a sense that our home is a source of comfort and sunshine. We have two actors here to help us out with demonstrations. Our actors are using the names Wendy and Steve. Hello, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Hello.
They are playing an invented couple that has bits and pieces from many couples that I've worked with over the years. Let's begin by taking a little bit of a listening peek into Wendy and Steve at home. It's a nice day. They've worked hard. They both just arrived home, and we're listening to what their house sounds like on the good days.
Oh, I'm beat. But I missed you today. Did you have a good day?
It was an okay day. Not too bad. The weather was nice anyway.
Yeah.
We were outside most of the day, so that was good. How about you?
Oh, it was great. We finally made our goal. I'm so glad.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it takes
good.
A lot of pressure out of my life.
And mine too, then, I guess.
Yeah.
As we listen now, we'll hear what goes on sometimes at Wendy and Steve's dinner table. Wendy wants the TV off. Steve wants it on.
There you go again, TV addict getting his fix.
You just don't know how to enjoy life, honey.
Are you ever going to grow out of that juvenile addiction?
Who's juvenile? You're the one who keeps teddy bears on the bed still.
I told you not to tease me about that.
You're just getting what you deserve.
Don't give me that you deserve it nonsense. Take responsibility for your own mistakes. Grow up.
What a bitch. Nag, nag, nag. Every night you're on my case about something. Get out of my face.
By the end of our discussions today, you'll be able to listen back to that dialogue and hear precisely what happened that got them off course. Wendy and Steve actually started dinner feeling very amicable. Then, when Wendy wanted the TV off, her way of asking for it made a sharp right turn off into the fighting. Let's figure out what it was that happened that got them off course by listening how they could talk about the very same issue in a different way, utilizing some different skills that enable them to get off to a constructive start. They're still at the dinner table, and Wendy starts it off in a new way. Picture that above Wendy and Steve, there's a spotlight on a swivel. Notice that whenever Wendy talks, it's as if the spotlight focused on her, and that the only data she sees when she's talking is the data lightened by the spotlight. So all she can talk about is her own feelings, her own thoughts. Now, this isn't to make her selfish. This is to enable her to be centered and to give self-disclosures. Now, there will be many times during the day which they'll chat about this, that, and the other thing. But when there's a problem to be discussed, a touchy topic, then it becomes very important that each party just give readouts of their own thoughts and feelings. Start with the pronoun I. When it's time for data to come out about Steve, you can imagine the swivel spotting the light down on Steve. Picture, as you're listening, where the spotlight is as each speaker is talking.
Steve, I've been troubled about something. Can we talk about it for a few minutes?
Sure, Wendy. Well, sort of sure. I hate criticism, and I feel anxious when you say there's trouble. But I do want to know what's on your mind.
Well, it's about our dinner times.
I love your cooking. Everything's delicious. I'm gaining some weight, I think.
No,
but
no. It's not what we eat that bothers me. It's our talking, or our not talking.
I hate silences, too. That's why I like to turn on the TV when we eat.
If we could talk with each other as we eat, I'd really like that, to share what we've done that day, to share our experiences.
They're off to a pretty good start. Could you picture the light swiveling back and forth so that each party was exploring their own feelings and sharing them with the other person? That's the key to saying things. There are three skills that we're going to talk about now as the basic building blocks that enable people to have constructive dialogue about touchy topics. The first is how you say things. The second will be how you listen. And the third will be what do you do with emotions. The key to the first is you speak about yourself and ask about the other. Speak about yourself and ask about the other. Now, that sounds so simple, of course. What else would you do? Let's see what else we all, from time to time, do. First mistake, passivity, saying nothing. It's easy for us to say, oh, it doesn't matter that much, no big deal. I can live with it. I don't want to make a fuss. The problem is if we don't speak up about problems that bother us, they gnaw. Sooner or later, we do erupt, maybe about something else. Let's listen how passivity sounds. They're still at the dinner table, and this is how they start. Steve?
Great TV program.
Yeah.
Does not bode well for a fun dinner time. Difficulty number two. I like the term crossover. If you picture your swivel spotlight, if instead of talking about what's going on with yourself, you cross over and start talking about the other person, that's what I call a crossover. The other person's territory is their thoughts, feelings, who they are as a person, what they want to do. Let's see what happens if Wendy begins by crossing over and talking about Steve. You'll notice the pronoun you. And then we'll switch and hear what happens when Steve does it.
You always get quiet when we sit down to eat.
You look at me as if I'm supposed to be saying something.
What did you each experience, Wendy and Steve, as you were doing that? Did it feel like you were off to what was going to be a productive exploration?
No.
No.
Rhetorical question. I apologize.
Right.
Okay. Well, again, let's hear that very same starting. Instead of you get quiet when we sit down to eat, Wendy, how could you start?
I like to talk when we sit down to eat.
I like to watch TV.
At least their cards are out on the table. Now, that rule about speak about yourself, ask about the other, rather than doing crossovers, sometimes gets people caught in a bind because, sure, it's nice to tell him or her what I feel, only what they're doing has something to do with what I feel. True. It has something to do with what you feel. It doesn't make you feel. What's the difference? Let's say Steve is watching TV. If it wasn't Wendy sitting with Steve, but somebody else, how might that other person feel? They might feel engaged in the TV program. They might feel, oh, this is togetherness. I'm sitting on the same side of the table with my husband, and we're both enjoying this program. It feels so good to laugh together. Or they may be sitting there thinking, what a dummy. He doesn't have any thoughts in his own head. Why did I marry this idiot? They could be in an angry, grumpy. In fact, what are you feeling as you're sitting there with Steve, Wendy?
Ignored.
Okay, so the issue for you is ignored. In other words, Steve's behavior isn't making Wendy feel. Steve's behavior exists, and Wendy's reacting to it. To get that point across, it's helpful to refer to what the other person is doing with a subordinate clause. Now, this helps you know that it was worth all those years of taking English. Do you remember what a subordinate clause is? If the subject of the main clause is I, then you can refer to what the other person is doing, subordinating their actions with the word when. I feel da-da-da-da when you're doing this, not you make me feel. I feel this when you're doing that. So it's a reference point that helps the other person know when that reaction is coming up. Wendy, you want to start by saying what you feel and referencing what Steve is doing at that time.
I like to talk when we sit down to eat. And when you become silent or turn on the TV, I begin to feel shut out, and I think you're ignoring me.
Notice, she didn't say, you're ignoring me. She says, I begin to think that you're ignoring me. And she didn't say, you make me feel. It was, I feel.
I like to talk when we sit down to eat. And when you sit there like a moron, I begin to feel like a moron too. And I feel ignored.
Ah, we caught you by surprise there, Steve. There was an additional problem in that one. What word stood out for each of you from all that dialogue? Let's hear it.
Moron.
Right. No matter how many nice things were in that sentence, that word moron is going to jump out. And it's going to jump out because that word is toxic. So we've talked about passivity, not saying. We've talked about crossovers. And now it's the problem of toxicity. Any word with negative implications that's used to describe the other person has potential to be toxic. What do we do when we get something toxic inside of us? We spit it out, hopefully, or else it could cause some real damage. And we do the same with information as we do with any other kind of toxic substance. Our body somehow tries to eject it. Now, toxicity comes in several forms. We heard moron. Wendy, Without using such inflammatory language, what's another way you could convey toxicity?
I like to talk when we sit down to eat, and when you sit down and turn on the TV, I feel ignored.
So already we're beginning to hear an edge of anger in there. And anger has inherent in it a message of you're not okay. And then if the anger has more edge to it or more volume, it's going to carry that much more of a you're not okay message of a toxicity. And it's going to be rejected or defended against. Another common error that people make in trying to say what they want is instead of saying what they want, they say what they don't want. How would you feel if you brought your film into the camera store and when you came back the next day, they handed you back all your negatives? You would feel a little cheated. Somehow it doesn't give you the information you wanted the way the actual positive, the picture would. Well, that's essentially the same process that happens if somebody speaks in what they don't want as opposed to conveying what they want. Wendy, explain what you want, but via the negative to Steve.
I don't want to sit in silence at meals.
Now try it in the positive.
I would really like us to be able to talk comfortably together at meals.
Could you feel a difference, Steve, in your gut as you were listening to those two?
Definitely.
What would you describe?
A negative always seems to solicit a negative response. I don't want this, and I don't want that either.
To mirror what the style in which it came up. And the positive?
It seems like a place to start. She's kind of saying, this is where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. Let's try the reverse. Steve, you started off.
I don't feel like talking every night.
As opposed to?
I sometimes feel anxious. I withdraw into silence when that anxious feeling comes up in my chest.
Big difference. Let's do a little exercise here. For instance,
the problem is that you're always on my case. If you weren't so demanding, maybe I'd talk more.
What was that? Go ahead.
It's your fault.
Exactly. It was fault-finding or blaming. Now, using the terms we talked about before, is blaming and fault-finding what category, what word? Where is your focus when you're blaming or fault-finding? It's negative and it's on the other person. So it's a crossover and it's toxic. It has elements of both. Wendy?
I have a real problem with your selfish self-absorption.
Honest.
Is it honest? It is an honest description of how she reads him. The toxicity is certainly impressive in that. And also, she's attempting to solve the problem by criticizing. Where's the focus as soon as you start criticizing? On the other person, it's a crossover. So again, criticism, like fault-finding and blame, are both toxic and crossovers. Double reason why they're a very bad start and pretty much guaranteed to derail any constructive, collaborative problem solving. So why would people do that? Well, there's a funny phenomenon that happens as we get angry. And we all sometimes get angry because there's something we want and we're not getting, or because we're tired and hungry, or because of a number of causes, because we didn't like something that happened the day before, because we're mad at the kids and we're displacing that on our spouses. Unfortunately, as soon as we get angry, something happens to our perceptual apparatus. It goes in the direction that our eyes are pointed outward. And all we begin to see is you. Whoops, that's all we need to start doing crossovers. Then an even worse thing happens. The more we get angry, the more intense our feeling, what happens to our image of the other person? It gets more negative. The extreme is by the time two countries go to war, both countries will be writing in the newspapers about the people in the other country as if they're villains or ogres. And then as peace is declared, you'll see a whole change in the rhetoric. Suddenly, there'll be more understanding, more empathy, and the villainizing will decrease. That happens within households as well. The more angry we are, the more we're prone to use negative images like selfish and self-absorbed. Those statements say more about the speaker and the emotional state about the speaker than the recipient. As we get to know Steve and Wendy more, we'll begin to see how that terminology really misses the point of who he is and what's going on with him. Okay, that's the short course on how to say things. Keep it eye-centered, speak about yourself, and ask about the other person. Let's switch now to the other half of a communication. Communication is a little like baseball. It involves something like catch. You have to put forth words and somebody has to absorb them or the activity hasn't been completed. It takes a speaker and a listener to have one completed unit of communication. Well, that's obvious, but again, we don't always act like it's obvious. Because if in our listening we don't give some sort of evidence that we've really taken in or caught the information that's been given to us, then what is the other person going to experience? They're going to experience frustration. Odds are, if they're not certain that their partner has heard them, they'll say it again, say it louder, say it in a different way, give up and feel depressed, or there'll be increasing tension, none of which are outcomes that keep collaborative dialogue going. So let's see what somebody has to do as they're listening to make a completed communication. Let's have a nice example from Steve and Wendy. Steve, maybe you start off the dialogue here.
I do get anxious at the dinner table.
That helps me to understand what's happening when you aren't talking. What do you think the anxiety comes from?
What did Wendy do that made it sound like she had really taken in the data?
She asked for clarification.
She asked for more information, clarification, exactly. And she commented on his words. That's another way of giving evidence. So we don't have to turn into automatons and just repeat exactly what was said before us. On the other hand, if you don't give some evidence of what you've taken in and build what you say in response on what happened before, if that doesn't happen, what's going to occur? Steve says he gets anxious and then Wendy starts talking about something else. Either Steve will get frustrated and or they'll begin to develop a style of communication that's like railroad tracks. One is going down one side, the other is going down the other side. They keep moving at more or less the same pace, but there's no sense of interaction. They're not quite building on one another. So a good dialogue has listening that's like digesting and then taking that information as the jumping off point for the next comment that's made. Let's listen to some other mistakes that people make in listening. Let's try listening like a lawyer. Excuse me, I don't mean to insult lawyers. And in fact, let me give you a preamble here. Lawyers are trained to read and listen very carefully for what's wrong with something. If you're about to sign a contract, you want your lawyer to scrutinize that document and find everything that could be wrong or could go wrong in it. If your spouse listens to you in that way, for what's wrong with what you just told them, it's not quite as pleasant. Let's listen to what it sounds like.
I do get anxious at the dinner table.
You don't always get anxious. Like, last night when our friends dropped by with a picnic, you were very relaxed and a lot of fun.
What did she do with the information that he gave? She showed him how it was wrong. Very cooperative, very friendly. Showing him what's wrong with, rather than listening for what was right with. Or what was useful in the data he gave. Or what makes sense. So effective listening involves listening for what's useful, what makes sense, what's right about, not what's wrong with, and not listening like a detective for what's really going on behind what he or she says.
That really undermines what I'm feeling, too, because if I take any stock in what she says, then I go away with that information and I go, well, if I'm not anxious every time, then what am I? Or, you know, and then I start to... pick apart what I'm doing and what I'm not.
Yes, it's very undermining, anxiety-provoking, and confusing when you try to put something forth and the other person says, no.
I know you better than you know yourself, in essence.
Yes, it's demoralizing to be shown what's wrong with. Now, there's a key word that tips us off when somebody is doing lawyer-like listening or listening for what's wrong with. It's a little three-letter word. But.
Well, I get anxious when I feel I have something to say.
But I don't care what you say as long as you say something.
But I worry about it. I get anxious when I feel I have to talk at dinner.
But you don't have to worry. I don't care what you say as long as you're talking.
But I do worry. I do get anxious.
But what you say doesn't matter. Just talk.
How much information was left out on the table at the end?
None.
Or perhaps one piece. The last person who spoke, that information is still out there unless the next person then says, but. What does but do? I used to say, but is an eraser. It erases whatever comes before. Now I have entered the age of computers, and I would say, but is backspace delete. It deletes not just one letter, but the whole thing that came before. Yeah.
She's leaving a lot more information out than that. She says, I don't care what you say, so I'm not interested in what you're saying.
Yes, but conveys its own non-verbalized information, which is a discount, or it doesn't matter what you say. Steve put out one piece of information. I'm anxious at dinner. You can think of it as being the first brick in some kind of building that he was about to build with her. A building of shared understanding. A bridge of shared understanding. What did she do with the bridge? Her butt knocked it out of the way. And in place, she put her brick. Well, when he heard that, what did he say? He said, but, removing her brick and putting his back out there. Now, as many times as they did that, and they went back and forth about 8 times, and you'll notice, if you listen back on that, that both of them used but, which is what often happens in a couple. Usually, one butter begets a second butter. Most dialogue turns into mirror talk. People mirror what each other say. So, as that mirroring of the buts happens, each but subtracting out what happened before, all you're left with is the last piece of information. There is enormous data loss. It's a subtraction process. How would we change that process of subtraction to addition? What word connotes addition? Everybody. And, thank you very much. Let's read that very identical dialogue, only this time, in every place it says but, you're going to use the word and. Go for it.
I get anxious when I feel I have to say something.
And I don't care what you say, as long as you say something.
And I worry about it. I get anxious when I feel I have to talk at dinner.
And you don't have to worry. I don't care what you say, as long as you're talking.
And I do worry. I do get anxious.
And what you say doesn't matter. Just talk.
What was your experience of that dialogue? It was written as a but dialogue. And it has the frustration. And dialogues, in fact, don't have that kind of repetitiveness that a but dialogue has. So that wasn't a real and dialogue. But they just said the same thing over and over again because they had to keep putting that brick out again and again because it kept getting removed. In and dialogue, you get a sense of forward momentum, as if one foot goes in front of the next, like you're walking along forward. There's cumulative information, and you'll hear that as we go on with subsequent dialogues. Question back there.
I understand when you switched it from but to and, but, you know, if I was sitting there with my partner and they told me they didn't care what I was going to say, I mean, I'm not going to say anything. If they don't care what you're saying.
It doesn't take very many buts to turn some people off.
Yeah.
Couples vary in their tolerance for but dialogue. Some people will hear one but and they'll clam up, and on the other extreme, some couples can butt back and forth until they've really escalated in intensity. It is very upsetting to not be heard. In fact, the single most frequent escalating factor in a relationship is feeling like you're not being heard, like somehow your data isn't getting registered in the other person's computer, or that there's two separate computers and then it's not one shared data pool. The goal is to have one computer that you both share and have all the data that's put into that one data pool get hit with the save button. So it's all somehow in there. Each of these skills is meant to preserve data and prevent data loss. Yes?
So if you are in the middle of a but dialogue, are you saying then that you can change it by just starting into an and?
Yes. I can tell you a funny story about that, actually. There is another author that I got into a dialogue with. He envisioned himself as the big expert, so he was used to being the authority. I said a sort of an innocent comment, and he came back with a but and then stated his comment. Well, somehow talking with him, it got my ego involved too. So I said my but back. And then he said his but, and I said my but. And then he said an interesting thing, which was partly a nice thing to do, and partly, as I thought back after it, not quite nice. He said, I'm feeling uncomfortable. I feel like you're not hearing what I'm saying. What's your reaction? Go ahead.
That you started it?
Yeah, that's the message I got also. Of course, when I look back on it, it was clear to me he wasn't hearing what I was saying. And that is how these things often proceed. We each can see so easily what the other person is doing wrong, our eyes being pointed outward. At the same time, he did something that was very important, which was he stepped out of the dialogue, stepped aside and sort of looked at what we were doing and commented on the process instead of just continuing to talk about the content. He said, if I put it in nicer terms, hey, I think we're not hearing each other. Or I think somehow there's a wall between us. Let's start again and see if we can both really take in what the other person is saying. Let's take that very situation only one step worse and see if you can understand what Steve's doing that's a really high-level listening skill for when somebody else is attacking you and yet you want to get things back on track with effective listening. Let's see, in response to Wendy's comment here.
I just hate eating dinner with you, with your stupid, selfish silences.
Yes, and I also don't like dinner time when my anxiety whelms up and drowns out whatever thoughts I might otherwise put into words.
What did he do? Now that's a fairly amazing turnabout that he did. The attack came out, and what was the first word out of his mouth? Yes. Not I. Yes. Yes. Oh, we've got some good listeners here. The first word was yes. What does yes do? It does two things. It disarms them, and it gives you time to think. So when the attack comes on, and when a stray comment comes that really is toxic, you can start by saying yes. The next word, and. It's buying you time, and it's conveying that this is going to be a collaborative discussion. It may have been started with a barb, and it's about to be converted to collaborative discussion. That's what and says.
What if you say, and yes, I think you're pretty stupid too.
Then the game is lost. Yes. That won't do it. Yes and alone aren't enough. What needs to come next is something very interesting. You need to have been genuinely listening for what was the useful or true piece in what that person said. It doesn't have to be the whole of what they said. You can pick up on a word. When Wendy said, I just hate eating dinner with your stupid, selfish silences, he picked up on the word silence. That's listening for what's useful in. He picked up on the word silence, and then he put a new frame around that word, a positive frame instead of a negative frame. So instead of calling it stupid, selfish silences, he said, yes, and my silences are a problem for me at dinner time also. I call that technique detoxification. Let me warn you, nobody can detoxify on and on and on and on and on. But often, when a conversation is beginning to slip into something unpleasant, somebody's feelings were hurt inadvertently, or they were tired or irritable for whatever reason, an occasional toxic comment can be detoxified in that way. Yes, and pick up on some idea or even a single word that was valid or useful or interesting in what the person said, and put a new and more acceptable frame around it. Yes, and my silences are a problem for me also. I do get really anxious and then I get real quiet. Now, there's another aspect of listening that I call bilateral listening. Bilateral meaning two-sided listening. One of the key skills I use to assess how emotionally healthy individuals and couples are. How capable are they of hearing both sides in a dialogue? Of hearing their own thoughts as opposed to discounting their own concerns and adding to it the thoughts and concerns of the other person. That's the ultimate in listening. Let's hear what that sounds like. Steve and Wendy?
Well, it sounds like you really want to have conversations at the dinner table, and like I really want to disappear into the TV set, mostly because I get very anxious as we sit at the table face to face.
I would like for us to find a way so that we can feel comfortable and you're not anxious with me, and so that I have the sense of connecting and sharing. That's what marriage is supposed to be about.
Could you hear how both of them were giving indications that both sides were being taken in? In the process of verbalizing their bilateral listening, they used another listening technique that's very potent and grossly underutilized, and that's summarizing. Summarizing what the other person said and what your concerns are, with symmetry, so both of them are out there. Okay, that's the basic skills that have to do with listening. Let's move on to the third of the three building blocks, emotions, without which collaborative dialogue just isn't going to happen. Emotions, like many things in life, are the source of what's the best in life and what's the worst in life. Emotions can be the keys that unlock the door to what's most important. They also can be the keys to the locomotive that takes off and destroys everything. So, how do we use them constructively? Rule number one, when an emotion comes up, stop the dialogue and look at what's caused the emotion. If it's come up in you, stop and ask yourself, wait a minute, why am I getting so uptight here? If it's come up in the other person, stop and ask them, wow, a few minutes ago we were having a good discussion and things have really changed here. What are you feeling? Ask. Or what happened? So rule number one, stop when emotions come up and find out what they're about. Rule number two, keep an ear open for the emotional intensity. The more intensity, the less listening and the less constructive saying, and the more danger that everybody will go off track. Question back there.
Aren't you really assuming that each person is able to do some introspective looking to, in fact, evaluate what they're feeling? Because I could give you the scenario of, wait a minute, just a couple moments ago, everything's... Why are you feeling so angry? Well, it's because of you, what you said. I mean, isn't that more the norm?
The ability to look inward, figure out what you're feeling, and then articulate that is a cornerstone in conflict resolution and collaborative decision-making on any touchy topic. The opposite of that kind of insight and self-expression or self-disclosive comment is blame. As soon as you hear either partner switching from articulating a readout of what they feel and think to blame, crossover toxic, you better just stop there because nothing productive is going to happen there on in. And if you or your partner are consistently doing that, that's a good sign that it would be very helpful to go for help. People don't slip into that kind of blaming because they're bad people. They slip into that kind of blaming because they suddenly feel wounded or hurt or angry. And if they are easily getting wounded or hurt and therefore angry, they can probably benefit a whole lot from some therapy that helps them understand that touchiness, that vulnerability, and not only understand it, but move on to feeling stronger and more confident and more comfortable with themselves so they can tolerate looking inside, seeing what they feel, and expressing it. Okay, that's the basic skills, building blocks, to sequence people from conflict to resolution or from an episode of conflict back to calm.
This concludes part one of the three-part series, Conflict Resolution for Couples.